So we're going to talk about faith. Buddhism, the thing I like about Buddhism particularly is very direct. It doesn't muck around. So who has faith in the Buddha Dhamma? Who's not sure? Yeah? Good. Who hasn't got faith in the Buddha Dhamma? You're all converts, are you? Zealots. The thing I like about the faith related to the Buddha Dhamma is that it's not based on blind acceptance. It's based on understanding certain principles and believing in them. Now, there are some principles we can't prove. Very difficult to prove rebirth. You may even, some people even remember their rebirths, but they can't prove it to somebody else. Some might say that's just a figment of your mind. There was a very famous story of one lama. It was a Tibetan Buddhist lama, and it was in a book called Blazing Splendor. And this lama, very famous Tukul Ogyen, was interviewing lamas through this book. And typically people that have realizations don't really talk about them, but because he was a very high lama, he was able to get information out of some of them. And towards the end of the book, he asked one particular Buddhist practitioner, one teacher, what his realizations were. And he said, oh, look, I don't normally talk about it, but he said, all right, for you, he said, I'm not like the great masters. He said, I don't have the qualities of the great masters. He said, I can only remember my previous 500 rebirths and my next 500. Which is quite shocking to most of us. It was shocking to me when I read it. His previous 500 rebirths and his next 500 that he's going to have. And my teacher once told me, he said, once you develop calm abiding, single point of concentration, he said, you can remember your rebirths like what you had for breakfast. But if we haven't attained those states, then they're kind of fantasy for us because we haven't got kind of the understanding of that. So there are a few things that are outside our logic in a sense that we can't concretely prove them. So we don't worry so much about that stuff in developing our faith. We worry about the things, or think about the things, that are actually important. And when we concentrate on the stuff that we really kind of understand, that develops our faith. I'm going to do a little bit of reading in this because there's some very good quotes. Normally I just talk, but I'm going to add a bit to it. The Dharma of the Buddha is not a religion of blind faith. It is far more demanding than that. It is a religion of experience, of exploration and discovery. The Buddha said his teaching was come and see. Few of the great teachers in history have had such a bold and confident claim. His teachings not only withstand methodical explanation, they demand it. And my first teachings with my teacher in 1978, before all of you were born, I remember sitting there I wasn't a Buddhist at that stage, I just went to a Buddhist course in Queensland at Chen Raising Institute. And the thing that I was most impressed is every time he talked about something, he said, don't take my word for it. You check up. You check up if it's real, if it resonates with you, if it makes sense to you. And during that course, there was one guy, which he was kind of like the iconoclast. Do you know what an iconoclast means? Does anyone know what that word means? It means image destroyer or faith destroyer, you know, someone that tears down icons like the Buddha. And during this course, every time the Lama would say, well, it's like, you know, the Buddha's teachings pervade the universe like the stars. And the guy goes, well, that's not really true. How do you, you know, that's just an allegory using stars and Buddha's teachings. And he kept doing this the whole course. And he was kind of what I think the term is white anting our kind of beginnings. And this is really early Tibetan Buddhism in Australia. Really early Buddhism in Australia in many ways. And so he went through 2 weeks and this guy was getting more and more bold. He was going, oh, yeah, well, that's not provable. Yeah, and that's not provable. And then we came to the last teaching of the day. And the last teaching of the week, I mean, of the 2 weeks, was on the nature of reality. And my teacher, Geshe Loden, sat there firstly with a flower. And he said, this is the flower. Everyone, flower. And we all went, yep, got that. We know it looks like a flower, is a flower. It was very basic. And then he pulled a petal off and he said, is this the flower? Or is that the flower? And you go, that's interesting. Is this the flower? Pulls another petal off. Or is that the flower? Then he pulls another one. And another one. Another one. And then he's just got a stalk. With a little knob on it. And all the petals there. And he goes, where is the flower? And I'm sitting there going, Something's starting to stir here. I'm not sure where this is going. And then he goes, okay, Geshe Loden. Arm. Is arm Geshe Loden? Is this Geshe Loden? And he pretends to take the parts of his body off. Their mind. Is mind Geshe Loden? Which part of the mind? Yesterday's mind? Tomorrow's mind? Where is it? Where is Geshe Loden? Where is flower? And at that stage we're going, uh-oh. And that went on for about 2 hours. And I went down to the kitchen completely stunned. I didn't know what... I'd experienced something, but I had no idea what it was. I went down to the kitchen and I was sitting next to a monk and I went, so nothing exists. And he said, if I slap you, will it hurt? I went, yep. He said, well, think about that. Oh, no. It's not that and it's not that, but it is that. Anyway, I saw the same guy who was the skeptic. And he was like, someone had hit him with a rock. He was like, I said, so what do you got to say? I don't know. I don't know. And what I really understood was, you can't prove something exists, but you can prove it doesn't exist. That was a reality. And that shocked all of us. I can't prove to you that's a cup. For an ant, it might be a mountain, or for a kangaroo, it's a hopover. But I can prove to you there is not one particle in that cup that proves it's a cup. There is not one atom. If there is an atom in there that proves it's a cup, then it has inherent existence. But the cup is empty of cupness. Which bit's the cup? The rim? The handle? And that's what nailed my faith in Buddhism to begin with in 1978. That was the highest truth that I could understand. That all phenomena exist as dependent arisings. The cup depends on its shape, its colour, its size, and its label. I label that a cup. Therefore, it is a cup. Which bit is the cup? All of the bits together. Where's the essence of cup? It doesn't exist. There's not a bit inside there that says, "Oh, this bit's the real cup." Just molecules. Just atoms. Just electrons. Any science students here? No? You're all commerce, are you? Very wise. And we keep going down into quarks and energy waves and whatever, and we can't find the essence of cup. And that was the beginning of my faith, and I went, right, now we need to investigate this, because there is no other truth or wisdom higher than that understanding. That everything is empty of inherent existence, and everything arises on dependence of its parts, causes and conditions. To have that cup, it has to have causes and conditions. And what do we call causes and conditions? We call it karma, doesn't it? Don't we? For something to arise, it has to have a cause. And for it to exist, it has to have the conditions. And so all of a sudden, I started to build this logic for myself. And I went, okay, I can certainly accept that, that nothing is independent. Does anyone want to challenge that? Oh, come on. Give us a debate. No? Do you accept that? Not sure? You're not sure? Whereabouts is the cup? Just there, isn't it? I'm using it as a cup. If I smash it into small pieces, where was the cup? It exists by way of conventionality, by causes and conditions, but it has no nature of its own. We impute on that its function. We impute on that its label. And so by just looking at that, that's the basis of what, for me, Buddhism is about developing faith, about the logic of that. Because of this role, the role of faith faculty in Buddhism, it's kind of difficult to grasp. And so it says, we should clarify that by faith, I mean the enlightenment factor and spiritual faculty of confidence and conviction. So do you understand now a little bit more about faith? It's not, oh yeah, I believe. Oh yeah, yeah, there's the Buddha, I just believe in the Buddha. You have to develop a conviction. If you don't really believe in the technology of what Buddhism is doing, then you can't proceed with it. If you don't believe something like meditation is beneficial. If you think, oh, I don't know why people meditate. In fact, I did, years ago, I had a girlfriend, a Jewish girlfriend, actually, for a few months, and she said, what do you meditate for? She said, what's the point? And I went, oh, don't worry about it. I decided not to explain, because for her it meant nothing, absolutely nothing. It had no connection with any reality that was worth doing. You just sit on a cushion and you watch your breath. Sounds ludicrous, doesn't it? But when you practice that, when you actually sit down on a cushion and you actually practice meditation and you arise from that cushion, something shifted, hasn't it? Your agitation's gone, your mind seems calmer, you look at the world differently. When the mind's agitated, how do we look at the world? Not very well. When the mind's calm, we have a different view. Has the world changed? No, our view has changed. And so the faith of developing in Buddhism is recognizing that our mind is the critical factor of our happiness and our sadness. It's, please.
Can I ask a question? I mean, meditation, there's quite a lot of evidence, as far as I know, in the scientific literature about that it works. So why do you need faith?
Why it doesn't fail?
Now, why do you need faith?
Ah.
You have to pick up a scientific journal or read this
stuff. Yeah, meditation. Because there are certain qualities within Buddhism that are beyond just logic. When we talk about realizing emptiness directly, the actual nature of realizing the nature of emptiness, that's beyond just ordinary meditation. When we look at rebirth, when we look at karma. Karma is not a scientific fact that you can put in a journal. Sure, and I absolutely agree with you. And that's the wonderful thing about meditation. Is there a, did you know at the moment in the world there are 700 papers being written on meditation in universities right across the world? 700. Last estimate. It could be more. So absolutely agree on that. But when you start to look at some of the other subjects like karma, cause and effect, we live with cause and effect. We do something and something arises. We get in a car, we put a key in the engine and we turn it on. And we totally expect that car to go. I've had cars that don't, but generally you expect them to turn on and move. That's cause and effect. The parts are in place and the key goes in and you turn it. So they're some of the things that are outside just the logic of meditation. But the beauty about it is that before scientific fact came along, they didn't actually have that reasoning. The Buddha, in fact, the Dalai Lama said, this is a number of years ago, he said, if science finds out that meditation is not beneficial, then Buddhism will have to change. He threw the gauntlet out. That was his faith before science had really investigated it. So eventually, I doubt whether you wouldn't be able to really scientifically evaluate karma. It's not a cause and conditions. It's not associated with the brain or whatever in that sense. So in some ways, we do need faith to proceed further than just the basic meditation. There are many people that just practice meditation. In fact, I teach many people that practice meditation. Yep.
But couldn't we say that it's just a different way of thinking that we're not commonly used? So because we live in this country, a faith can mean something different because of the traditional paradigm.
Yeah.
So it confuses the issue.
Yeah, and that's true
that's
too.
What Simon is alluding to. So it's a different way of thinking. We're just not at that level. Faith could be a loose term, it could be something else.
Yeah, well this is why I've used the term conviction and confidence rather than just faith. Faith is often associated with some mystical, in other traditions, a mystical God, and you just have faith in God and God will fix it up. Buddhism doesn't come from that logic, although, again, we have to have some faith that some of the qualities, like if we look at the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha started off, he had to develop faith in his early followers because this was new stuff, and he had to think, how am I going to present Buddhism to the world that people are going to actually accept it? So firstly, he started off with a truth and a reality, is there is suffering and dissatisfaction. So he went, okay. Everyone went, yeah, okay, we can accept that. Would everyone accept there is dissatisfaction and suffering? You could not, unless you've lived under a rock with no thinking whatsoever. We've all experienced dissatisfaction. Try hitting your finger with a hammer. Try getting a cold. We've all experienced dissatisfaction. So that's a reality. And at times we have a little less dissatisfaction, and sometimes we have a little more. When we have a little less dissatisfaction, that's called happiness. You know that old story about, this is going to destroy your happiness completely, but I don't mind. Lying on the beach. Oh, it's such a beautiful day. It's so warm. Oh, this is great. Oh, it's getting so hot. Oh, I'm going to dive in the water. Oh, it's so great in the water. Oh, it's really cold in here now. I'll go and lie in the sun. Oh, it's great in the sun. Oh, so fabulous. Oh, I feel so happy when I'm in the sun. Oh, I'm so hot. Chun, 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 chun. That's called changeable suffering seen as happiness. Miserable, isn't it? That's the part of Buddhism I love so much. It's so direct. Changeable suffering is what we call happiness. Oh, a chocolate bar. Oh, I love chocolate. There was a very famous Lama, Chogyam Trungpa, when I was at Chenrezig Institute. Again, they played this tape cassette in those days. Does anyone remember cassettes? Oh my goodness. There was a cassette of a teaching by Chogyam Trungpa. And he said, Chogyam Trungpa was one of the first Tibetan lamas to go to England. And he had a beautiful, beautiful English-speaking voice. He started a Samyling monastery in Scotland in the very early 70s, early 70s. And he said, you desire chocolate. He said, you want a piece of chocolate. And even the way he said chocolate made it sound exceptionally rich. He said, so you go to the shop and you pull your money out and you see the chocolate sitting on the shelf and you desire that chocolate. And he said, you ask the shopkeeper to take that block of chocolate down for you. And you pay your money and he puts it on the counter. And you pick up the block of chocolate and you unwrap it and you smell it. Is that the happiness? Is the smelling? Was the buying of it the happiness? Was the seeing it the happiness? Was the paying for it the happiness? Was the unwrapping, the smelling? He said, and then you take a piece of chocolate off. Click. Is that the happiness? And you put the chocolate in your mouth. And you rub it against your gums with your tongue. Is that the happiness? And then you let the chocolate liquid go down your throat. Is that the happiness? Whereabouts is the happiness? And we're all going, gee, he's just ruined eating chocolate for us. But it was really funny. Straight after that lecture, we all went down to the shop and bought chocolate. But the point being is that when you start to look at things like that, You also see the humour of Buddhism. Buddhism is not just straight kind of misery and suffering. It's actually humorous. The way that we deal with our lives is actually quite funny. We get so upset about certain things. I have a partner. She's Buddhist. And enormous things can happen to her. And she can just handle them. You know, really difficult situations. But if she can't find something she's looking for, or a piece of paper or something on a computer, she goes right off. And I said, the smallest things send you off and the biggest things don't worry you. She said, yeah, that's right. And we're often like that, you know. We let ourselves be pulled by ridiculous things. It doesn't matter in the long run, in many ways. And we get so serious about things. But in the end, a lot of the things we worry about don't come to pass. And the things we don't even think about hit us full force. So it's quite unexpected, quite often. But anyway, getting back to faith, having conviction that these truths actually matter. Now, one of the other ones that we have to have faith in. So the Buddha talked about the first noble truth of suffering. The next one takes a little bit more of a jump. He said there's a cause of that suffering. There's a cause of that suffering, which is our own actions, our own mind. But then if you analyse that, you have to say, well, there is only our actions, there is only our minds. You know, this table doesn't tell me how to think. I hope it doesn't. This table doesn't teach me how to think or make me think. It's my mind that is experiencing this existence. My body is in this existence and my mind experiences it. And I do things. And those things seem to bring results. If I study, hopefully I pass exams. If I don't study, I can pretty much guarantee I'll fail them. Well, there's a cause and effect. Very simple. So we kind of run our lives on that basis. So to say there are causal factors in our experience, that would be pretty logical, wouldn't it? There has to be something doing it. One of my friends, a Buddhist monk, to a brand new group of students, never done Buddhism before, they're all sitting there, and he goes, "It's all your fault." And he said, and that's the good news, because if it's somebody else's, he said, you're in deep trouble. He actually used a different word, but I won't be impolite. But he said, you're in deep trouble, because if you finally realise you're the creator of your happiness and your suffering, then you have the controls. That doesn't mean initially that we don't experience difficulties in our lives, but those causal factors are due to our consciousness. Even if we don't accept previous lives, we can see the stupid things we do in this life that causes grief, don't we? Putting your phone down on the bus seat and then getting off the bus. Oops. How many people here have lost a phone? Caused you a lot of grief, doesn't it? Whose fault was it? It was the bus. Bus did it. Someone distracted me. It's their fault. It wasn't me. I didn't do it. There's just little things like that cause us grief, and we're the causes of those. So we have to accept there is causality to things. You know, putting out... Where did you lose your phone, by the way?
In a
shopping centre. What, did you put it on a seat?
Went back.
Yeah, and it fell out, did it? Or?
Someone stole it.
Oh, right. So, how'd you lose yours? Your phone?
In a restaurant.
In a what?
In a restaurant.
In a restaurant.
Did you put...
So it was the restaurant's fault, was it? Yeah. So we have to accept that. So there is a cause to our suffering. We're on a very simplistic basis. The next two, there is a way out of suffering. Let's have a look at that. If we are the cause of our dissatisfaction, then it would seem logical that we are the cause to remove dissatisfaction. That would be logical, wouldn't it? Okay? That if we, from a Buddhist perspective, see, other religions have a different view. Okay, they believe that the supreme creator either makes us happy or not happy, or does this or does that. Buddhism doesn't come from that angle. We are the creators of our happiness and sadness. For me, that was a relief. I was brought up basic Christian education, and I found it very difficult thinking that a supreme creator was causing my difficulties and my suffering. I had a bit of a problem. I'm not criticizing other religions. There are some fine people I know in many different religions that are absolutely wonderful human beings, so it's not criticising that. But for me, from my experience, I found the idea of a supreme creator that I had to worship when I couldn't see him, I had no understanding of him, and he was omnipotent and omniscient, and I couldn't get it. For me, it was a really tough call. And I think that's why I looked for so many years to find answers to the reality of things. And so when I finally came across it at 23, it was such a relief to be able to have something where I could firstly dissect it. I didn't have to believe in it. See, if you're a Christian, you have to believe in God. You don't have an option, you know. And that's fine for the people that believe in it. In whatever level they believe in. So there are many different, like all of us, in many ways, all of us have our own religions. We have our own Buddhism, Christians have their own Christianity. You'll find one Christian has a feeling, an experience like that, and another one like that. So in a sense, we're individuals in that way, and the same with our own Buddhism. We have our own practice, we have our own way of looking at things, and we have our own ideas. But there is a cohesion there. There's a cohesion of acting positively that seems to bring positive results. There's a causal factor. If we just look on the judicial system, when we're bad people and we rob banks, we end up in jail. When we end up in jail, that's extremely unpleasant. How did we get there? Because we robbed a bank. Very obvious. So the causal factor of suffering is doing something negative. However, when we're extremely generous, we don't go to jail, unless we're Robin Hood, using other people's money. But if we're extremely generous to people, not only are they happy about it, that we actually feel good from the reciprocal energy, or just the feeling of generosity actually gives us a good feeling. So we start to look at the quality of virtue and go, okay, well, Buddhism and again other religions too say that a virtuous mind brings happiness. Ah, okay, well, that's another piece that I could put on into Buddhism that I can have faith in. And that negative actions per se bring unhappiness. Walk down the street and yell at somebody and see if they want to be your friend. It doesn't work. Today I had it was really sweet. I was in Rose Bay, O'Sullivan Road, and I'd just been to the shops. I was just getting into my car and there was a woman, she was probably in her 80s, and she said, are you going along the road? She said, I can't get a bus or a taxi, and she had a bag of shopping. And I wasn't really going along the road, but I had the time. And I went, yeah, hop in. And I said, how do you know I wasn't a bad man? She went... And I drove her right to a door. And she shook my hand and said, you've done a really nice thing today. And I said, yeah, and I'm very happy I had the time and the energy to do it. So there was the situation. Just opportunistic. Made me feel good, she was happy, she got home, all worked. So those situations, you feel good. I could have turned around and said, go away. Don't you get near my car. I've just polished it. You know, I'm being ridiculous here, but in the sense, there was a situation where I could have said no. I actually wasn't. I was going this way and she was going that way. And I did a 5-10 minute detour. Big deal. So I think that really comes out of the desire to be generous that I have received from my teachings. My particular teacher, Geshe Lodin, was unbelievably generous. Every couple of years, and people gave him a lot of donations, he would empty his bank account, every penny of it, and send myself at one stage to India to give all the money away. And someone said, he's never happier than when he empties his bank account. Gives him great joy. So I saw an example of that. That's the other point that I will make about faith too, is have a look at the people around you who you consider maybe as good people, maybe as good Buddhists, maybe as teachers, and have a look at the way they act. Do they act in accord with a virtuous mind, or do they act against it? And so I developed great faith in my teacher by just being around him. Constantly, over 38 years, he always acted in accordance with a virtuous mind. He always acted in accordance with bringing benefit to someone else. I'm not saying it was all sweet and gentle. I've been yelled at. In fact, sorry.
I don't understand why you had to have faith in him, because you had evidence that he was like that. So I just don't understand how you're using that word faith. I mean, I suppose I'm a bit... I understand how the Christians use it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is blind faith. They seem to make a virtue of faith over reasoning.
So. Yeah. Well, the next step... Okay, so this is logic. I saw all that. But I have to also have faith that I will achieve enlightenment. I have no proof that that's happening. But I believe, due to all the other things that have put in place over 38 years that I've examined, that I can see from my side that are true, then some of the bits that I don't know, I have to have faith that they're achievable. And that's the last, thank you for saying that, that's the last noble truth, that there is a cessation to suffering. I have no proof whatsoever that that's the case.
After that point, you use logic, haven't you?
Logic, but no concrete evidence. How can I say there is an end to suffering when I haven't ended suffering? You can say to me, oh, well, I've ended suffering. Believe me, that doesn't that doesn't cut. I have to have faith that that side of it is correct. So there are certain things we can examine and say, yeah, that's logic. My teacher was generous. Generosity creates this. Yeah, yeah, all those things. And I totally agree there. The faith, in a sense, in the end, is those things outside. They say that when you see emptiness directly, you are no longer bound by attachment or aversion. Not just an understanding of emptiness, but actually a direct realization of emptiness. I hear this many, many times. The direct realization extinguishes the desire of attachment and non-attachment. The reason for that is that when you see emptiness directly, there is no value different between that, or that, because they're all empty of inherent existence. We create value by our attachment or our aversion. So I have to have faith that that's a possibility. After a long retreat, my teacher said, just trust in the process. Just trust in the process. Which we could use in different terminology, have faith in the process. And so in that, do you understand where I'm coming with from that?
Well, I can understand that you should, trust something and give it a go and see what happens.
That's faith. That's actually faith. Because if I only do what I see as concrete, then the subtler messages that I haven't achieved probably won't come along. That's all it is. It's really this conviction that this is the right way to go. If, however, I go, oh, well, that's all logical, but I don't know about the rest, I may not proceed to the higher practices or the deeper meditations or continue to practice. If someone said, oh, well, generosity is good, just be generous. And there are plenty of people that do that. But there's more to it than for me. There's more of the science of the mind. And I've observed there are certain people, and I've been around the Dalai Lama, that seem to have a quality that I definitely don't have. And that the normal people I've been around don't seem to have. And I realise that that's due to his very deep practice and his understanding. And so, in a sense, that's the kind of idea that I'm talking about. I'll read a little bit more. How can I put this? The question naturally arises, faith in what exactly? And this guy's writing from personal experience. I would like to suggest three things we ought to have faith in. Looking at this question strictly from the practical viewpoint of progress in meditation. The yogi must first of all have faith in the practice. Without this confidence, you'll get nowhere. So, again, logically, you do a bit of meditation, your mind feels calm. But to say, okay, there are deeper truths than just having a calm mind, you have to have some kind of faith. You have some experience, you have faith. Without this confidence, you will get nowhere. In an actual retreat situation, this also implies faith in the teacher and his instructions. If you can't feel complete confidence in the teacher, then it suggests find another teacher. You won't get anywhere if you question the meditation instructions all the time. For the duration of the retreat, you kind of have to faith that it's going to have some success. It shouldn't need to be pointed out that faith in the teacher is not guru worship, which has no place in Buddhism. Faith here is not a helpless dependence on another, nor is a blind belief that the teacher is flawless. It is, or ought to be, a feeling of trust and confidence in the Dharma presented by the teacher as something valuable and worth heeding. During a practice session, it should be the courage and discipline to follow instructions instead of the whisperings of a monkey mind. The second thing that the Buddhist must have faith in to succeed is the third noble truth, that there is an end to suffering. This, I think, and this is, again, not me, the guy that's writing it, the only metaphysical belief that is absolutely essential. Indeed, it may very well be the only one that is not actually a hindrance. It is not something susceptible to logical proof, only to the confirmation of direct realization. See, there again, that's what I'm talking about there. It talks about, the Buddha talked about the end of suffering, of the fourth noble truth. That has to be faith in that that's actually the case. Because until you actually realise it, it's a myth. That's where I'm talking about faith. Or confidence, again. Probably faith is not such a good word.
And I think that's what's messing me up. Yeah. Probably talked to too many Mormons.
Yeah.
They have this faith that it's completely delusional.
Yeah. So, in a sense, that's why it keeps delineating in this particular article that I'm reading out that it's about confidence. Having a knowing.
That sounds much better.
Yeah, okay. All right. We'll just use confidence from now on, just to make you... Faith's out. Confidence is in. No, but that's good, actually. And that's a really positive thing, because having confidence in something is really this conviction that this is going to work, even if I don't know it's worked yet. In fact, I taught someone, a layperson, meditation about 3 months ago, a business person. I sat down with them and I said, they asked me to come and see them in their home, a very big business person, huge operation right across the world. And they said to me, look, I hear meditation's really good. I've never really been able to do it. And I'm telling you now, as they said to me, I can't concentrate for more than 2 minutes at a time. She said, I've got ADHD and it just doesn't work. And I said, I promise you, in 2 months' time, you'll be meditating for 3/4 of an hour. And she went, no way. I said, yes way. The end of 2 months, right, let's do 3/4 of an hour meditation. She went, okay. And at the end of it, I went, there you go. She said, yep, I get it. So, stupidly, she had enough faith in me to think that she could do it. But she did. And she saw the benefit of it. And during the 2 months, she said, oh, wow. She said, I'm doing it every day. And she said, I just feel better going to work. I'm clearer thinking. I'm less reactive to difficult situations. And that now, and we continue to practice months later. We're actually doing practice. In fact, I see her tomorrow morning to sit with her. And she wants to go further. Interestingly enough, she's asking me more and more about Buddhism. The ideas of Buddhism. How does that fit? I'm not giving it too much. You don't try and convert people by, oh yeah, well this. I just tell her stories about lamas and things that I've experienced. And she, at one point, I was telling her one story. She said, oh, I wish I had, my teacher died in 2011. She said, I wish I had met him. He sounds like a really cool guy. I said, he was this really cool guy. He was really, really good to be around. But not always his teachings, as I said earlier, were always gentle. Sometimes they were quite wrathful. But never once in the time where I was being naughty and getting disciplined did I ever feel it was about his reaction to me. It was always about me clearing my head. And that was a really interesting experience in 38 years. Not once did I feel like, oh, what's he getting? You know, sometimes it wasn't comfortable, but I always got the feeling that it was for my benefit, not his. And so those kinds of things start to build the attitude of faith. The attitude that build the attitude of confidence in the process, being confident in the process. And we do that anyway in our daily lives. We develop confidence in the process. We know that when we do certain things that they arise. I'm going to go on to this third one. So I've talked about the two things of faith. The third and final element of essential faith is for many of us the most difficult. It is one this person struggled with. You must somehow, and I'm going to superimpose the word, have confidence in yourself. Many happily believe that the Buddha or various people are enlightened, but they think they could never do it. I've heard people say, oh, I'll never get enlightened. I go, wrong thinking in Buddhism. In fact, I ask you all now never to use that phrase. It's incorrect. absolutely incorrect. To say, oh, I will never reach nirvana, or I'll never be enlightened, or I'll never achieve arhatship or whatever, is wrong thinking. What you are negating there is your own Buddha nature. The fact that we have the essential nature of our consciousness is Buddha nature. And that's the thing that I found really interesting in Buddhism, is that you don't achieve enlightenment by getting something out there. Enlightenment is not out there. Because if it's out there, you won't get it. Enlightenment is actually here. And enlightenment is the removal of delusion. They asked the Buddha what he had gained in meditation. He said, I gained absolutely nothing in meditation. But I did remove anger, hatred, obsession, greed. And that's the great news. It's not out there. If enlightenment was something you had to acquire outside your own consciousness, not acquirable. It's like saying, acquire someone else's consciousness. Go and get a Buddha's consciousness and then you'll be enlightened. Ridiculous. Your friend's really smart. I'll just acquire their consciousness and pass more exams. Ridiculous. Not possible. So it's not outside ourselves. And that was the thing that really resonated. And I found things in Buddhism that just delighted my mind. It's just accorded with my own logic. That's why I'm a Buddhist. In fact, the Buddha said, don't accept anything through your love for me, except when it accords with your own mind. And again, that was a reinforcement to the way I wanted to accept and look at things. That it's through your own wisdom that you develop your practice. It's the removal of your ignorance and your delusion that achieves enlightenment. So, here you have enlightenment encased with your rubbish. You just get the rubbish removal man, yourself, or woman, to start taking the rubbish away. And then omniscient consciousness can then shine. And so it's like we've all got this diamond covered up with sludge. And we just have to remove the sludge. Oh, how do you do that? Ah, I think the Buddha's got some methods because he said it was possible. Interesting, in the Jain religion, the Mahavira, who was born 12 years after the Buddha, they accepted that he was enlightened, but they could never achieve it. They could achieve definite goodness, but they couldn't achieve enlightenment because it was too far refined from their ability. And that Mahavira was an exceptional being, but that he was just an exceptional being. Buddhism has a lot more joy in it than that. I'm not saying that the Jains aren't joyful. They're extremely pious and they're very, very, very honest in every dealings they do. In fact, the Jains are most of the diamond dealers in the world. They're extremely honest and quite wealthy. But the Buddhists said, okay, now you can achieve this state of enlightenment. Have conviction. And so having conviction in yourself is the final test of confidence. Being able to say, okay, I can do this. I can achieve this. You can't achieve it all in one go. You have to nurture your practice like feeding a little baby, bit by bit. But don't stop feeding. All right, important to keep feeding. Even if your practice is a little bit sloppy sometimes, pick it up. There's a saying, if every bodhisattva gave up when they made a mistake, then there'd be no Buddhas. And the Buddha, just like us, was an absolutely ordinary human being at one stage of his existence. No different. With the same delusions, the same hang-ups, the 84,000 delusions. And he achieved enlightenment through perseverance and practice. And so developing faith in oneself is really, really important. Confidence that we can do it. We can actually achieve states of realization. And we know that by the fact that when we've done a really peaceful meditation. You sit there at the end of it and go, actually, I feel pretty good. I feel really good at the moment. Just my mind is settled. After some retreats in Melbourne, we were doing some really quite advanced tantric practices in Melbourne with my teacher. At the end of the 3-week retreat, we were doing about 9 hours of meditation a day. He'd look at us and he said, if your mind has calmed down just a little bit, then good result. Here we are trying to achieve these high states of realization. He said, if your mind has settled a little bit, he said, then very good result. Just a little bit. And if that's our achievement, then that's worth praising ourselves for. So we have to also, as well as watching out and being mindful for our negativity, we also have to build on our positivity. We have to also recognise our success. And by recognising our success, we then build on that process. We can't beat ourselves up all the time. Who here gives themselves a really hard time most of the time? Anyone? Do you do? Stop it. Immediately. Tonight. I had one client who, oh my goodness, beat herself up all the time. And I said to her one night, I want you, she was a shiatsu patient of mine, so I was doing massage. And she was going, oh, this and that. And I said, I want you for 1 week not to criticise yourself. And she went, oh, no way, that's how I live. No, no, I can't do that. No, no, don't even ask me to do that. And I went, you live your life by criticising? She said, oh, yeah, I'm always criticising myself. I thought, ooh, I have to say, hasn't achieved much happiness in life. Little bits, but not a lot. So, we have two things. We have self-criticism, or we have intelligent regret. Oh, that was unskillful. I won't do that again. Oh, I'm terrible. Oh, it's shocking I did that. I feel so guilty. Rubbish. What did someone say? Guilt should only be found around picture frames. Guilt is an action of non-action. It's a thinking of non-action. Guilt is going, oh, I'm terrible. It's a terrible thing I did. True regret over a negative action is the decision not to do it again. Again, these are things that Buddhism constantly reinforces, this old idea of progression of consciousness, progression of activity, progression of confidence in our ability to move forward. So this last one, as I said, the final element is having faith in ourselves. It says here, interestingly enough, believing that you can't achieve enlightenment is a form of egoism, of ego grasping. It says here, why do you think anyway to be the only sentient being in the universe without the seed of Buddhahood? It's a great line. To say you can't achieve enlightenment says that you're the only sentient being in the universe that doesn't have the nature of enlightened consciousness at your very being. Okay. So, I just read this for a moment. Again, going back to the desire to always have happiness and not have unhappiness. And really what that means is contentment or the need for peace and harmony in our lives. We need to examine the Buddha's teachings and see if they make sense. Really easy. Examine them. Look at each one and go, does that make sense? If we have a sense that they make sense, if we understand that they make sense, then we develop some trust. Then another good way of developing this confidence is looking at other practitioners, other Buddhist practitioners. Do they act in accord with our own reasoning? I'm not saying everyone's perfect, but are they trying to act in accord with the values that we hold important? Do they have compassion? Do they have patience? Or even if they don't have it, are they trying to be patient? Do they apologise when they've done something wrong? Or do they just blame the world for their misery? See, a Buddhist, unfortunately, we can't blame the external world for all our troubles. Yeah, bad things happen, you know. But really, in the end, we're the deciding factor. And I had one friend of mine who became Buddhist many years ago, and he was walking past a bookstore, and this guy had been a worker on the Snowy Mountain scheme. He'd been a rigger with cranes. He was a serious tradesman, never looked at faith, never looked at Christianity, no faith whatsoever. Wasn't interested in religion of any kind. But he'd had a tough life. He'd had three marriages. The last one had gone wrong, and he was suffering, and he had difficulties in his life. And he walked past a bookstore, and he walked in. And he picked up a book by a guy called David Mickey, Buddhism in Everyday Life, I think it was called. And he turned over the cover, and it said, "If you're reading the back of this cover, it is not a coincidence." And he went, "Whoa, that's shaken me. Why would I walk into a bookstore, pick up a thing that says, if you're reading this, it's not a coincidence?" He never even thought of that before. Bought the book, and he sat down, and he went, "This has gone wrong in my life. That's gone wrong in my life. That's gone wrong in my life. That's gone wrong in my life. This hasn't worked. What's the determining factor here?" And he went, "Oh my goodness, it's me. I'm the consistent factor in every one of those things that didn't happen." Very clear logic. Whoa, that's called karma. I think I better go and find out about that karma. Then he ends up coming to our centre and doing a course. And these days he's a Buddhist. And he lives his life very simply by watching what karma is creating, and his life has improved out of sight. He says it's really, really, really helped him to understand what was going on in his life. And when something negative happens, as sometimes for all of us at various times, he goes, "Ah, it's a result of karma. Okay, now I know how to deal with this." Very difficult if something happens and you have no logic for it. It's like, why is the universe doing this to me? The universe is not doing it to you from a Buddhist perspective. But if you think that's you're always a victim, aren't you? Someone out there is pulling the strings. Stop it! We're doing it ourselves. And so for him, that was the development of confidence or faith. That this stuff actually made sense. So then he investigated it and it made more sense. Some of the ideas of emptiness, he goes, "Oh, that stuff kind of goes over my head, but I really understand karma. I really get that from his own experience." And so he's found his own Buddhism that has really helped develop his life. And he has confidence that that's the truth. And he said some of the stuff he doesn't understand, but he actually has the confidence that it's actually correct. He just hasn't got there to understanding it yet. And that one day he will. And the same with me. When I first heard my first lecture from Geshe Loden on emptiness, I thought, there's no way I'm ever going to get this. And about 2 months later, I sat with a monk in my kitchen at home, and I asked him to explain emptiness, and he talked to me for 2 hours, and I didn't get any of it. How can something exist and not exist all at the one moment? That's just not possible. How can that be? It means it's not one or it's not two. Where does your lap go when you stand up? And at which part does it dissolve? We all have a lap. We stand up. Do we have half a lap? Or a quarter of a lap? Where does it go? That's a puzzle. And I gradually went, okay, well, I just have to have some conviction that the rest of it I really agree with, and I think that's pretty good. And the rest I'm going to have to just keep out there until I actually finally understand it. And that's having the conviction in the practice, in the Dharma. Knowing that I think we're going in the right direction. So developing again this conviction or faith, looking at the Buddha's teachings, firstly we look at his life and what made him embark on the path of realization. Going right back to the beginning. The Buddha had everything, every comfort. He then saw disease, old age, suffering, and a monk. And he wondered why this happened. Didn't all of you at some point wonder what was going on? I know I did. I was about 9 years of age. And I was standing in the backyard of my parents' home, middle class Sydney, going, what is going on? Why am I here? What are those stars? Why are they my parents? Why am I living in a house? What is going on? This is really at 9 years of age, and then I went, there's got to be a reason to this stuff. Something. And then I thought, I don't think, pointing back at my parents in the house, I don't think they know. I've got a feeling they don't know. And it wasn't a blame or anything. I just kind of had a feeling up until 9 years of age, they didn't really know why. And I really wanted to find out why. And it took me another 14 years before I found out why. So I looked, I did martial arts, I did yoga, I did all these other things, which I don't do yoga, but I still do martial arts or Tai Chi. And I hadn't dropped the practice because it's very beneficial for your health, but it didn't give me the answer. And when I came across Buddhism, it was like such a relief. Here are some teachings that I can really actually trust. I believe that the cultivation of a virtuous mind is beneficial. After 38 years, I can say, absolutely, I have total conviction. For me, rebirth seemed very logical when I came across it. A lot of people have a struggle with that, actually. I found that one of the big hassles for a lot of people. Oh, how could you have a previous life? And I think, how could you not? I don't think I just winked into existence. I get an idea that there is a continuum. I don't think all of a sudden, there I was and there I wasn't. I don't think things, for me, that wasn't logical. I believed in what the Dalai Lama said. If you can remember when you were a little child, you had consciousness now. Consciousness, in a sense, means knowing. Or knowing of your existence. We have that sense, don't we? We have to say at some level we know we exist. And then I knew that I exist when I was a child too. So why can't that moment of consciousness give rise to the next, and why can't I follow it backwards? So rebirth was okay for me. I'm not talking about personality going from life to life. That Rod Lee lived in another life. No, Rod Lee didn't live in another life. Rod Lee is in this life. But in a previous life, there was a continuation of consciousness. So that made sense. So that was easy to accept. Yep?
Part of part of the claim for that, though, is that memories live on into a, or go into another life. You're trying to apply logic to it, but I don't understand. Nobody's ever explained where those memories are.
No.
Are they uploaded to some celestial cloud somewhere and then downloaded later on?
They talk in Buddhism about seeds of consciousness that are continued within the stream of consciousness, which are karmic result, karmic causes and conditions. So they're actually in consciousness, they're not up in cloud.
No, but I mean, how do they transcend death then?
Hmm?
How do they transcend death, these memories? Because if you look at people like, look at Alzheimer's and dementia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The memories go. I mean, the brain decays and the memories go. So it seems to apply that the memories are held in the brain, in the physical sense.
No. Those actual understandings, according to Buddhism, the brain is a vehicle, but it's actually consciousness that holds those memories. Otherwise, you couldn't possibly, if they were only stored in the brain, you couldn't possibly remember previous lives.
Well, that's my point, really.
Yeah, that's right.
No, so, I mean, because they are held in the brain.
So that's where, exactly what we were talking, that's where I have to have confidence that that's true. That's faith.
That's
faith that exists. Otherwise, you go, well, logically, if it's only in the brain and the brain dies at death, then there can be no past memories. Mm. And yet, lamas have told me that you can remember your past lives.
Yeah, telling you and giving reference for a
different thing. Ah, that's faith. That's why I believe them, even though they can't show me. Yeah. And that's why I was saying, you can't. This is the problem also with karma, because they say that karma created in a previous life can happen now. Why do good people have bad things happen to them? And they say that's a result of previous karma and causes and conditions from a previous life. Now, to say that I this is absolutely unprovable. I cannot prove that.
That's
Yeah, yeah. I have to have faith that that's actually true. The Buddha said it. My teacher said it. And everyone can say, well, prove it. And I said, absolutely no way. Again, I can't prove to you that this is a table. If you think it's an orange,
that still makes some sort of sense within a sort of philosophical.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're talking about, I don't know. I mean, one definition of faith is the willful suppression of critical thinking, and that seems to apply to Christians quite well. But you're sort of
taking
these ideas and saying there's no evidence for it, so why should we believe it? What's the difference between making something up and presenting these ideas?
Exactly. And that's why, yeah, and it's a really good point. Those are the things that are unprovable from a logical point of view in Buddhist thought, that there is previous lives. Unprovable. The reason I believe in it, because all the other tenets that I've experienced are correct. I also believe, yeah, and that's you could call that blind faith. Say, okay, everything's logical up to there, and then all of a sudden there are these ideas that there are other realms of existence, God realms and various realms, that there are the universes that Buddhism talks about. They talk about the multi-universe, unprovable in science.
Well, there's an idea in science about multi-universes.
Hmm?
There is an idea in science.
Only an idea.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Only an idea. Buddhism was talking about it way before. It was actually only in 1996 that science said there was multi-universes.
Well, I have an idea there.
Yeah, an idea that there were. And mathematically possible within theorems. But again, unprovable. So within Buddhism, there's a lot of unprovable stuff that you have to have. You don't have to. Sorry, have is the wrong word. That I myself believe in. Yep.
University makes a fine art of critical thinking. So your degree is worth nothing if you don't have critical thinking.
Yeah.
So critical thinking, you know, whatever you do well at university, so you think you're really smart.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't open. Normally doesn't open the doors to wisdom. And I think it produces a certain type of logic, which is not flexible. It's very fixed.
So that's an interesting point. Just stop there. Look, before you go on to that.
I'll just finish really Because
okay, all right, all right. Yeah, we'll go back to that. But just think of the word logical.
Logic
yeah.
is very fixed. It has trouble with some of the things you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So when you use faith in another culture, it means something different. But when you use it in a Judeo-Christian paradigm, it muddies the waters.
The point I'm going to make is I don't think logic is rigid.
No, the Western critical thinking.
Yeah.
Sort of
logic. I think true logic also has to be totally flexible.
Yes.
With it an addition of truth. And I think that's really important, that flexibility. And that's something that I find is actually important in Buddhism, the flexibility to move. To give you an example, this goes back, could be 10, 15 years, maybe 10 years. I was at the end of a retreat, we were doing a fire puja. And a page of the fire puja fell into the fire. We all went, ooh, that's a pretty weird omen, you know. And then they retrieved it, and right through the word fire, there was a burn mark. In the puja, it had fire, and then through that Tibetan word, there was a burn mark. I went to my teacher later, and I went, what does it mean when a page of the puja falls into the fire? And he goes, it might mean that a big fire is on its way. And I went, oh, gosh. And then he said, and it may mean that a big fire has been averted. I went, ooh. And then he went, and it may mean nothing at all. And then he goes, it just depends, doesn't it? And I thought, right, what a fabulous answer. You either know or you don't know. And your logical thinking may change. This is why I say to people when they're meditating, do never centre on the experience as being true, whatever it is. I was doing a retreat, just a two-day retreat. This is, oh, God, 20 years ago, maybe longer. And at the end of the retreat, this girl came up to me. A lama was taking the retreat, and she said, oh, I'm really annoyed. I said, why? She said, I had this experience in meditation. She said the walls were running in gold and I felt totally blissed out and, you know, the altar was running in gold, liquid. And she said, and I went to the lama and told him, and he went, so what? She said, he didn't validate my experience. I said, well, you're very lucky. She said, why is that? I said, because you would spend the rest of your life trying to recreate something that may or not have been valid or not. Never. And this comes from Zen Suzuki Roshi. Experience everything you do as a beginner, particularly in meditation. Because whatever you centre on, oh, that was great, if you try to recreate it, you've just fallen into a big trap. They call it I can't remember the Tibetan word. There's actually a word for it, which means an indication you're doing quite well and your biggest obstacle has just arisen. You have a blissful experience. Oh, right. Now I'm going to have a blissful experience every time I meditate. You've just blown it. You have to let that go and let that go and let that go. And that's critical thinking that then becomes flexible. So, yes, you're right. If it's rigid, you're in big trouble. You have to open yourself to the possibility of other things happening. And that really is mindfulness. I talk about this in communication with business where you talk to someone, or someone's talking to you and you've already listened, rather than accepting completely openly the communication. That I got from Buddhism. It's fascinating to see so many of the Buddhist ideas now being accepted in modern idioms and in modern creations. I walk into companies and I talk about ethics, communication, all the things that Buddhism talks about. Meditation for calming the mind, logical thinking, all these different things. Planning, all this comes from my idea of Buddhist faith. And I hope at some point some people go, that's interesting, like this person that I'm teaching meditation to goes, I want to know more about Buddhism. because that's really, for me, the joy of getting it, without even pushing it or anything. So again, going back to this idea, and thank you also for your input, the idea of accepting truths because things have built up, but not accepting them blindly, still investigating them, still accepting them, saying, oh, well, that's a possibility, but I don't know yet. I don't know about these states of higher states of meditation or where the mind can hold things single-pointedly, but I have some feeling there may be a truth in it, and I also have trust that what the Buddha said and my teachers have said and many, many, many extraordinary teachers are all talking about the same thing, that there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's a way out of suffering, and there's an end to suffering. And that, to me, is the basis of what the Buddha developed in having faith in the process. Questions? We've got about 15 minutes to go. Any questions? Any more questions? Anything in the box? Interesting question. This is a great question. What should you do after you help someone and they mock you, attack you, belittle you and take advantage of you? What should you do? You've gone and helped someone and they treat you like rubbish. Well, for a start, what did you want from them? Did you want praise? Did you want money? Did you want them to pat you on the back and say, you are a wonderful person? Or were you giving freely? Beautiful point for... This happens constantly driving. You let someone in, you stop, you let someone in, they never wave. And you go, I just let you in. Has anyone experienced that? No? You're quite happy to let them in and they never wave? That's good. In fact, I think everyone should not wave. You should wave whenever then, but no one else should wave you. So you're constantly looking at what you want back from people. Because the point being is, if they do that, probably not a great idea to have them within your relationship. Okay? Because they're not really being very kind to you. Don't have expectation, but if they give you a really hard time, then probably not good to hang around. You're not meant to be a doormat in Buddhism. You don't just go, oh, everyone, here, I'll empty my pockets. I remember I was in Greece one time, and I was in a bar in Greece. I was travelling when I was young, and this guy just bought a drink, American guy bought a drink, and he said to the guy, oh, how much? And he didn't understand. He just opened his wallet to the bartender. The bartender just went, that's stupid. You don't just go, okay, well, walk around with your money hanging out of your pocket and going, handing it over. You have to have some degree of looking after yourself. No one can take advantage of you unless you allow them. There's a Chinese saying that says yin will only push yang as far as it will go. Or yang will only push yin as far as it will allow it to go. So the last bit of it is someone takes advantage of you. Nobody takes advantage of you. You allow it. Bottom line. So don't allow it. I had someone contact me just recently. Oh, they contacted me a while ago. I won't get too specific because I don't want to slander them, but they asked me to do Tai Chi classes and meditation at a particular place. And I went over there to do the meditation. It was a kind of a centre they were setting up west of Sydney. And I had a great idea. Come and teach meditation. I said, well, I will teach Buddhist meditation on the proviso that any money you get, you can give to my centre. And I'll teach Tai Chi and that money you can give to me because that's my practice. So I went there and on a Wednesday night, and there I was, and they went, oh, sorry, no one's turned up. Oh, two people said they might come, but they haven't come. I said, did you advertise it? They said, oh, we put up one poster. I said, did you put it on the internet? No. Did you tell many people? No. Okay. So that was one Wednesday night that no one was there. And they said, oh, but come on Saturday, you teach the Tai Chi. So I went on the Saturday, no one turned up. Did you do a poster? Oh, yeah, we put one up. Oh, there was one person who said they were going to come. Went, great, okay. I don't hear from them for 10 months. I get an email 5 days ago. Oh, I just come up with a great idea. You could do the meditation and the Tai Chi at the one time. And I think I may have 3 people to do the Tai Chi. And the meditation, we'll give them a 20% discount if they do the meditation and the Tai Chi. And I think we might be able to get $70 or $75. And I worked it out that I would have to get there about 9 o'clock because I had to travel. I would do 2 hours of practice, 1 hour of meditation, which is fine, 1 hour of Tai Chi. If the 3 people turned up, they said they wanted a cut, so they'd probably take half of that. So it'd be $35. By the time I paid petrol and parking, that's another $10. So I might make $25. And it would take me from 9 o'clock till 12 o'clock to make $25. I apologised to them and said that I didn't have the time because I kind of realised this wasn't very logical for me running a business, and suggested that I gave them a number to contact someone else who may be in their area, and I didn't receive another note back saying, oh, thanks for the tip, or sorry you couldn't make it, nothing. So I don't feel I've been ripped off. I tried it out. I realised these people didn't have their act together. And I did say, look, if things later in the year develop, give me a call. So I don't feel like I've been taken advantage of. I'm kind of amused at their lack of business logic, that they wanted money from $75 and I would work all morning and travel to make $20. That's fine. They can ask, and I have the right to say no. And so I don't feel like I've been taken advantage of because I didn't say yes to it. I weighed up, I looked at it logically and went no. And that's the same thing with this. Yeah, sometimes we help people and they can turn on you. I did this once. I used to teach this woman. This was going right back to the days when I lived in the country, and I taught this woman meditation weeks on end, and she was really rude. And I did it for about 6 weeks, and then in the end I thought, you're really quite rude. She was kind of belittling me, and I went to her place, I didn't charge her any money. She was an older woman, and she was really rude, and I thought, actually I'm not doing it anymore. It doesn't seem to be working for you. You're still being really quite difficult. So I decided not to, and she was even more rude that I wouldn't continue after 6 weeks. So we have a right to say, no, look, I'm sorry, I can't do that. You know, it's not about just giving and giving and giving and giving. You have to say, no, actually, I can't do that anymore. I don't have the time. And you're nice about it. You don't abuse people because if they're being horrible to you, they're having a difficult time in their own mind. They're unhappy. So be kind to them, but you don't have to continue with it. And some people are better not in your life. They're better not to be around you because it causes you difficulty. So you're allowed to say no. And if you help someone a few times and they're making life difficult for you, you might say, okay, well, that's, you know. If it's someone like an aged relative and they have maybe like something like dementia or something and you really need to help them because they need it, then you have to suck it up, okay? Then you have to go, okay, this person really needs help and I just have to go in there and help. They really do need help and there's no one else to do it. And just actually, if that's the case, you develop patience. So you can use that to develop patience. So you have 2 ways of dealing with it. If you choose to stay, then you really can't get upset about it. You develop as your practice of patience. And it goes back to the story of a teacher in the 10th century who went to Tibet, and he was a famous teacher from Nalanda University and revered in Tibet, and he created extraordinary teachings. And the Tibetans went to him, because he was Indian, and said, look, Atisha, we just want to talk to you about something. Your cook, he's the nastiest person we've ever met. He's really rude, he smells bad, and he can't cook. We will give you any cook in Tibet that look after you. And he went, oh, no. He is most precious to me. Without him, I cannot develop patience. That's the change of the mind. So if you can't change the circumstances, sometimes you just have to change your mind. And if you change your mind, then it becomes very interesting. That's the most powerful way. The example of the poison bush. You have a poison bush. It's no longer a cup. Poison bush. One way of dealing with the poison bush is not to go near it. Just stay away from it. That's one valid way in Buddhism not to engage a difficult situation. Okay? Just stay away from it. That's quite valid, and we can do that. Next way is to understand the root system of that poison bush, so we can kind of chop it out. Next way, we find that the poison bush, like snake poison, is a remedy, and we can use it, transform it. And the final way, they call in Tibetan Buddhism Atta Yoga, the final thing, and they say, for a peacock, eating that poison bush makes their tail very beautiful. It has no karmic consequences for them except positivity. Each one is valid depending on your level of realization. However, if your realization isn't the realization of a peacock, that poison bush will kill you. So we have different ways of experiencing situations, and they change. And we have to be aware of those changes to engage them in the right manner. Sometimes better to walk away. Sometimes better to understand. Sometimes better to transform. Sometimes better to eat directly. And that's all the teachings of Buddhism, right from Theravada to Atta Yoga. I hope that's answered that question a little bit. Any other questions? I think we've done it. Thank you again. I really appreciate being invited. I always enjoy coming here, especially, particularly the questions and things that come out. So thanks again. Hopefully I will be invited again. And see you soon.